The following program is brought to you by Audio Journal, a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind, with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, its staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome all to Audio Journal's Poets' Corner, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to poetry of people from all walks of life, of those from the distant past right up to the present day. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm George Bloomquist, and for the next half hour, I'll be reciting poems from the national best-selling book, Sailing Around the Room, New and Selected Poems, by Billy Collins, which was published in 2002 by Random House. Here's a quick thumbnail sketch about the author. William James Collins was born on March 22, 1941, in Queens, New York. Dubbed the most popular poet in America by Bruce Weber in the New York Times, Billy Collins is famous for conversational, witty poems that welcome readers and listeners with humor, but often slip into quirky, tender, or profound observations on everyday life, reading and writing, and poetry itself. In 2016, Collins was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. As of 2020, he is a teacher in the MFA program at Stony Brook, Southampton. Now, Sailing Around the Room is comprised of 5 chapters, each of which includes poems from Collins's earlier works. We'll begin today's program with the first chapter, featuring poems from his very first book of poems, The Apple That Astonished Paris, published in 1988, and we'll open with the humorous poem titled, Another Reason I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. It reads, "The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking at the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor, who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius." A yearning for escape and solitude is the subject of our next verse, titled, Walking Across the Atlantic. I wait for the holiday crowd to clear the beach before stepping onto the first wave. Soon I am walking across the Atlantic, thinking about Spain, checking for whales, waterspouts. I feel the water holding up my shifting weight. Tonight I will sleep on its rocking surface. But for now, I try to imagine what this must look like to the fish below, the bottoms of my feet appearing, disappearing. Here's Collins's humorous take on cultural differences and the fleeting nature of artistic expression in Plight of the Troubadour. For a good hour, I have been singing lays in Languedoc to a woman who knows only Languedoil, an odd Picard dialect at that. The European love lyric is flourishing with every tremor of my voice, yet a friend has had to tap my shoulder to tell me she has not caught a word. My sentiments are tangled like kites in the branches of her incomprehension, and soon I will be lost in an anthology, and poets will no longer wear hats like mine. Province will be nothing more than a pink cue on a map or an answer on a test. And still the woman smiles over at me, feigning this look of sisterly understanding. In our next verse, Billy Collins uses personification and symbolism to drive across the notion of history being ever-present and ever-important. It's called The Lesson, and it reads as follows. In the morning, when I found history snoring heavily on the couch, I took down his overcoat from the rack and placed its weight over my shoulder blades. It would protect me on the cold walk into the village for milk and the paper, and I figured he would not mind, not after the long conversation from the night before. How unexpected his blustering anger when I returned covered with icicles! The way he rummaged through the huge pockets, making sure no major battle or English queen had fallen out and become lost in the deep snow! Here's a wonderful poem in which Collins cleverly expresses the challenge of writing literature. It's titled Winter Syntax. A sentence starts out like a lone traveler heading into a blizzard at midnight, tilting into the wind, one arm shielding his face, the tails of his thin coat flapping behind him. There are easier ways of making sense, the connoisseurship of jester, for example. You hold a girl's face in your hands like a vase. You lift a gun from the glove compartment and toss it out the window into the desert heat. These cool moments are blazing with silence. The full moon makes sense. When a cloud crosses it, it becomes as eloquent as a bicycle leaning outside a drugstore, or a dog who sleeps all afternoon in a corner of the couch. Bare branches in winter are a form of writing. The unclothed body is autobiography. Every lake is a vowel, every island a noun. But the traveler persists in his misery, struggling all night through the deepening snow, leaving a faint alphabet of footprints on the white hills and the white floors of valleys, a message for field mice and passing crows. At dawn, he will spot the vine of smoke rising from your chimney, and when he stands before you shivering, draped in sparkling frost, a smile will appear in the beard of icicles, and the man will express a complete thought. So, you say you've got a bad case of writer's block? Well, Billy Collins has some sage advice for you in Advice to Writers. Even if it keeps you up all night, wash down the walls and scrub the floor of your study before composing a syllable. Clean the place as if the Pope were on his way. Spotlessness is the niece of inspiration. The more you clean, the more brilliant your writing will be, so do not hesitate to take to the open fields to scour the undersides of rocks, or swab in the dark forest upper branches, nest full of eggs. When you find your way back home and stow the sponges and brushes under the sink, you will behold in the light of dawn the immaculate altar of your desk, a clean surface in the middle of a clean world. From a small vase, sparkling blue, lift a yellow pencil, the sharpest of the bouquet, and cover pages with tiny sentences like long rows of devoted ants that followed you in from the woods. In the next poem, Collins fantasizes about getting the better of a literary competitor in The Rival Poet. The column of your book titles, always introducing your latest one, looms over me like Roman architecture. It is longer than the name of an Italian countess, longer than this poem will probably be. Etched on the head of a pin, my own production would leave room for the Lord's Prayer and many dancing angels. No matter. In my revenge daydream, I am the one poised on the marble staircase, high above the crowded ballroom. A retainer in livery announces me and the Countess Maria Teresa Isabella Veronica Montileri Eleganza de Belleferrari. You are the one below, fidgeting in your rented tux, with some local Cindy hanging all over you. You know, folks, I had to smile a little bit when I read in this poem, my own production would leave room for the Lord's Prayer and many dancing angels. I think it's a little bit of false modesty being expressed here. Because in 1992, Collins was recognized as the literary lion of the New York Public Library and was selected as the New York State Poet for 2004 through 2006. So the man has had many accomplishments over his life. There's more problems that writers have to face, other than writer's block. There is the matter, of course, of many restless nights, of not getting enough sleep, which is the topic of our next poem, titled Insomnia. It reads as follows. After counting all the sheep in the world, I enumerate the wildebeests, snails, camels, skylarks, etc. Then I add up all the zoos and aquariums, country by country. By early light, I am asleep in a nightmare about drowning in the flood, yelling across the rising water at preoccupied Noah as his wondrous ark sails by and begins to grow smaller. Now, a silhouette on the horizon, the only boat on earth is disappearing. As I rise and fall on the rocking waves, I concentrate on the giraffe couple, their necks craning over the roof, to keep my life from flashing before me. After all the animals wink out of sight, I float on my back, eyes closed. I picture all the fish in creation leaping a fence in a field of water, one colorful species after another. Worried about your weight? Well, Billy Collins puts such things in their proper perspective in Earthling. You have probably come across those scales in planetariums that tell you how much you would weigh on other planets. You have noticed the fat ones lingering on the Mars scale, and the emaciated slowing up the line for Neptune. As a creature of average weight, I fail to see the attraction. Imagine squatting in the wasteland of Pluto, all 5 tons of you, or wandering around Mercury, wondering what to do next with your ounce. How much better to step onto the simple bathroom scale, a happy earthling feeling the familiar ropes of gravity, 157 pounds standing soaking wet, a respectful distance from the sun. Books are truly wondrous things, as explicated in Collins's next verse, titled, simply enough, Books. From the heart of this dark, evacuated campus, I can hear the library humming in the night, a choir of authors murmuring inside their books along the unlit alphabetical shelves. Giovanni Pontano next to Pope, Dumas next to his son, each one stitched into his own private coat, together forming a low, gigantic chord of language. I picture a figure in the act of reading, shoes on a desk, head tilted into the wind of a book, a man in two worlds, holding the rope of his tie as the suicide of lovers saturates a page, or lighting a cigarette in the middle of a theorem. He moves from paragraph to paragraph as if touring a house of endless paneled rooms. I hear the voice of my mother reading to me from a chair facing the bed, books about horses and dogs, and inside her voice lie other distant sounds, the horrors of a stable ablaze in the night, a bark that is moving toward the brink of speech. I watch myself building bookshelves in college, walls within walls, as rain soaks New England, or standing in a bookstore in a trench coat. I see all of us reading ourselves away from ourselves, straining in circles of light to find more light, until the line of words becomes a trail of crumbs that we follow across a page of fresh snow. One evening is shadowing the forest, and small birds flutter down to consume the crumbs. We have to listen hard to hear the voices of the boy and his sister receding into the woods. If only we could, even momentarily, step out of time's grasp and all our worries of everyday life. Such is the yearning in our next poem, titled Bar Time. It reads, "In keeping with universal saloon practice, the clock here is set 15 minutes ahead of all the clocks in the outside world. This makes us a rather advanced group, doing our drinking in the unknown future, immune from the cares of the present, safely harbored a quarter of an hour beyond the woes of the contemporary scene. No wonder such thoughtless pleasures derive from tending the small fire of a cigarette, from observing this glass of whiskey and ice, the cold rust I am sipping, or from having an eye on the street outside when ordinary time slouches past in a topcoat, rain running off the brim of his hat, the late addition like a flag in his pocket." The following poem offers Collins's witty take on the omnipresence of death in our lives. It's called My Number. Is death miles away from this house, reaching for a widow in Cincinnati, or breathing down the neck of a lost hiker in British Columbia? Is he too busy making arrangements, tampering with air brakes, scattering cancer cells like seeds, loosening the wooden beams of roller coasters, to bother with my hidden cottage that visitors find so hard to find? Or is he stepping from a black car parked at the dark end of the lane, shaking open the familiar cloak, its hood raised like the head of a crow, and removing the scythe from the trunk? "Did you have any trouble with the directions?" I will ask, as I start talking my way out of this. Up next, Billy Collins expresses his frustration toward those of his students who view reading poetry as a chore rather than a joy, in Introduction to Poetry. I asked them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. In the next poem, titled The Brooklyn Museum of Art, Collins takes us on a lyrical journey into the transformative power of art, blending the boundaries between the observer and observed, the real and imagined. Here, then, is The Brooklyn Museum of Art. I will now step over the soft velvet rope and walk directly into this massive Hudson River painting and pick my way along the palisades with this stick I snapped off a dead tree. I will skirt the smoky, nestled towns and seek the path that leads always outward until I become lost, without a hope of ever finding the way back to the museum. I will stand on the bluffs in 19th-century clothes, a dwarf among rock, hills, and flowing water, and I will fish from the banks in a straw hat, which will feel like a brushstroke on my head. And I will hide in the green covers of forests, so no appreciator of Frederick Edwin Church, leaning over the soft velvet rope, will spot my tiny figure moving in the stillness and cry out, pointing for the others to see, and be thought mad and led away to a cell where there is no vaulting landscape to explore, none of this bird song that halts me in my tracks, and no wide curving of this river that draws my steps towards the misty vanishing point. In the final poem in Chapter 1, Collins invites us to contemplate the fleeting nature of time and its impact on memory in Schoolsville. It reads, "Glancing over my shoulder at the past, I realize the number of students I have taught is enough to populate a small town. I can see it nestled in a paper landscape, chalk dust flurrying down in winter, nights dark as a blackboard. The population ages but never graduates. On hot afternoons, they sweat the final in the park, and when it's cold, they shiver around stoves, reading disorganized essays out loud. A bell rings on the hour, and everybody zigzags into the streets with their books. I forgot all their last names first, and their first names last, in alphabetical order. But the boy who always had his hand up is an alderman and owns the haberdashery. The girl who signed her papers in lipstick leans against the drugstore, smoking, brushing her hair like a machine. Their grades are sewn into their clothes like references to Hawthorne. The A's stroll along with other A's. The D's honk whenever they pass another D. All the creative writing students recline on the courthouse lawn and play the lute. Wherever they go, they form a big circle. Needless to say, I am the mayor. I live in the white colonial at Maple and Main. I rarely leave the house. The car deflates in the driveway. Vines twirl around the porch swing. Once in a while, a student knocks on the door with a term paper 15 years late, or a question about Yeats or double spacing. And sometimes one will appear in a window pane to watch me lecturing the wallpaper, quizzing the chandelier, reprimanding the air." And now let's turn the page and go into chapter 2, which features the works from Collins's second book of poems titled Questions About Angels, which was published in 1991. We'll open with Collins's poem, American Sonnet. We do not speak like Petrarch or wear a hat like Spencer, and it is not 14 lines like furrows in a small, carefully plowed field, but the picture postcard, a poem on vacation that forces us to sing our songs in little rooms or pour our sentiments into measuring cups. We write on the back of a waterfall or lake, adding to the view a caption as conventional as an Elizabethan woman's heliocentric eyes. We locate an adjective for the weather. We announce that we are having a wonderful time. We express the wish that you were here and hide the wish that we were where you are, walking back from the mailbox, your head lowered as you read and turn the thin message in your hands. A slice of this place, a length of the white beach, a piazza or carved spires of a cathedral will pierce the familiar place where you remain, and you will toss on the table this reversible display, a few square inches of where we have strayed, and a compression of what we feel. We'll now conclude today's program with The Man in the Moon. He used to frighten me in the nights of childhood, the wide adult face, enormous, stern, aloft. I could not imagine such loneliness, such coldness. But tonight, as I drive home over these hilly roads, I see him sinking behind stands of winter trees and rising again to show his familiar face. And when he comes into full view over open fields, he looks like a young man who has fallen in love with the dark earth, a pale bachelor, well-groomed and full of melancholy, his round mouth open as if he had just broken into song. You've been listening to Poet's Corner, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Poets Corner, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117 or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org or by mailing us directly at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm George Bloomquist, thanking you for listening. And now, stay tuned for other local programming brought to you by Audio Journal. Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
The best way to avoid a scam is to talk about it, even if you're not sure it's a scam. Talking about the phone calls and emails you get can help you and helps those you care about. Someone might ask you for money or personal information, but do you really know who's behind that email or on the phone? They may not be who you think they are. Someone might want you to act now to give them money or personal information before you have time to think about it. Tell that person you need time. Then talk to someone you trust before you do anything else. Remember to call BBB if you suspect a scam or want to report a scam, even if you don't lose money. Your scam report will help prevent additional victims. Our toll-free number is 1-866-566-9222.